In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. It's John Suntress, and time for part two of my conversation with Jeff Parker. Now, in part one, you heard a lot about the Red Hulk, the Thunderbolts, and Jeff's new webcomic coming up called Bucko. We continue our conversation in part two. Jeff discusses his 2010 Oni book with Steve Lieber, Underground, and how a leaked PDF of the book at 4chan ended up being a positive publicity happening, resulting in new readers and sales for the Overlook Project. We'll also talk about the X-Men First Class film, talk about some of the old guard of comic creators like Alex Toth, Al Williamson, and Bern Hogarth, among others, and adventure comic strips. Plus, we'll get into some good old-fashioned movie talk as well. I think you're going to like it. Now, I'm still under the weather. My voice isn't perfect, so I'm going to stop talking and let you get right into part two of my talk with Jeff Parker right here on Word Balloon. You had another project that was different from superheroes, Underground. And that was an interesting year with that. Now, I've heard about 4chan and Steve Lieber's... am I right?
You can't stop that Steve Lieber. If he wants to go wandering into some crazy internet site, he will do it, man. He is not afraid.
But I want to know, and for people who don't know, would you mind... like telling the story, and then I want to know, you know, what the impact was from your point of view.
It's a great story because I don't figure into it at all. I was out on, and using my usual shenanigans, I was out on a boat. I bought this cheap boat off a guy, and I was dragging my kids around the aforementioned Willamette River, where you can see Fred Armisen dancing around. And so we're out having fun. Meanwhile, in the internet world, Lieber's on Twitter checking in, and someone says, "Hey, somebody just put your whole book up on 4chan." And 4chan, everybody I know who they are by now. Anyway, it's a gathering of anonymous people on the internet who apparently have unlimited time to just go fuck with people. So it's not a place you want to go make enemies because they will organize flash mobs to come after you. The best one I got to see, because there's a Scientology center down in Portland. Damn it, I wish it would just go away. But anyway, there's a Scientology center, and since a bunch of the 4chaners really got against it, they kind of protested it with a bunch of people out there wearing these Guy Fawkes V for Vendetta masks standing around. I remember I was riding my bike past that the day that happened. I didn't know that was going on, and suddenly I was going, whoa, what the hell are all these guys in Guy Fawkes masks doing standing out here? And they're just out there being conspicuous, just being annoying, and generally drawing a lot of unwanted attention onto the church. And that whole thing grew out of the fact that I believe that was when they saved that little bit of recruiting video where Tom Hanks is just acting like a nutcase. Talking about the church,
yep,
and how it's the only thing that can save anything. And you understand better than anybody. I understand better than anyone because I'm a Scientologist. And that was the kind of thing, you know, the church wanted buried really fast. And God bless 4chan for all the menacing they've done. They propagated that thing like crazy, and you can always find it on the internet because of them. So anyway, the church made a mistake in trying to go in and close down 4chan because you can't close down, an unknown mob. Especially an unknown mob with mad computer skills like many of them have. So they're constantly hacking. They recently got in a fight over with Tumblr about something. I wasn't paying attention though.
Interesting. Okay, I had no idea.
And they were slamming the Tumblr site. But anyway, this. Now, all that said, the comic section of 4chan is actually a pretty reasonable place. It's a bunch of big readers. You know, they're not just out there making trouble. They're into comics, and that's where they go talk about it. And this one guy put up the entirety of Underground, our graphic novel, our miniseries collected into a graphic novel that no one read because it didn't have anybody flying around shooting laser beams out of their eyes generally. And that's what does better in this climate. And
women that were trapped in an avalanche kind of.
Well, they're trapped. It's about two park rangers in a cave.
There you go. Two park rangers. Yes.
Yeah.
See,
and,
I read it too. Obviously. Okay.
So. Yeah. Good reason, Josh. Your comprehension skills are pretty awesome. But so anyway, this guy who was a real fan of it, he was just generally kind of upset because no one seemed to know about it. So he puts it out there, and then somebody goes and alerts Steve, hey, they just put up your whole issue there. And Steve, you know, can't not check that out. Obviously, I'm no help. I'm out on the boat doing God knows what, just riding around making hillbilly noises. And Steve goes and checks in and sees that the guy was, you know, genuinely a supporter who really liked the story and just wanted more people to know about it. And so Steve posts, and unlike everybody else with Anon, you know, he posts, I'm Steve Lieber. I did this. And it's like, you know, I'm not going to yell at anybody about pirating or anything, but if you got any questions about the series, I'll be happy to ask him. He just went in there being who he is, which is a nice guy.
Absolutely.
And surprisingly, treated very civil. Everybody was, there were only a couple of dicks in there who were just, you know, giving him hell, but everybody else was very supportive. And the next thing you know, just suddenly the orders start rolling in on the book. You know, people started reading it, and then they liked it, and then they ordered it.
Fantastic.
And then suddenly the order just shot up on Amazon, and all the stuff that we had on the Underground, the comic site, we started getting crazy hits on that. And then Steve talked to me about it, and he's like, maybe we should just put it up for free. It's like, I don't think it's going to hurt the sales to put it up for free in this case. And I said, hey, you're Mr. Internet, go for it. You know, you're the one going charging into 4chan. I'm just out ignoring the world. So, you know, we went ahead with that, and then bam. And I've always generally thought that's the way it is. Now, that's not the same thing as saying a lot of people are drawing the conclusion like, well, see, piracy works. What? No, that's not what we said. The reason this worked is because everybody saw that the creator was actually a cool guy and willing to engage and willing to discern the difference between somebody trying to help the book and someone trying to steal it.
Right.
You know, this guy was not putting the book up because he thought, hey, let's sell some ad space on this. This was not just a quick download, you know, with some other income connected to it. That 4chaner, I'm pretty sure, made no money. So, you know, which makes him just like us on that book. We were not making any money. And, you know, so we put up the whole thing. So you could read it as a PDF and then various formats, and you could read it all. And all we did was put the link and say, well, here's the Amazon link, here's Image Comics, you know, or here's a donation. If you would just like to read it like this and feel like you'd like to donate a little for all the time we put into it. And people are still donating. I was really shocked, actually. I didn't think the donation thing. I thought maybe there would be book sales. Because that's the way I am. I don't mind going and listening, doing something for free. But generally, if I like it, I'll go buy it.
Understood.
You know, I want to have it. I don't want to, and I'll go buy a CD because I don't want to, like, take the chance my computer dies. I didn't back things up, and I
sure.
don't have the thing. You know, and I believe a lot of people with books, music, things like that, they like to have the physical object and show people what they're into. You know, it's not good enough to, like, well, it's all on that little square over there, and I'll just tell you if you ask me. You know, I think it's a part of people reflecting who they are. I am these books, and I am these records, and all that sort of thing. So I've never thought that, you know, giving things away actually hurts you that much.
Well, then obviously, as you say, it promoted awareness of the book, and people responded in kind. And, yeah, there are good people that will, like you say, then say, oh, this does look cool. I will try it, and are willing to actually pay for it. But yeah, that's kind of interesting that, it happened the way that it did. And, you know, I don't know, does it influence how you approach any future creator-owned things, or do you hold back? You know, I mean, this goes back to that whole, thing that I think most recently Robert Kirkman brought up in his little manifesto and stuff, you know, and it goes back to what we were saying too about creating villains for the Marvel Universe, creating for yourself versus creating for the big two. And I mean, you know, I think you're in a very good place being able to put out these Marvel books and stuff, get people more aware of you, and then say, hey, if you like that stuff, come back and check my library of my previous creator-owned work, and, you know, hey, here's something new that I'm doing as well.
Yeah, and I hope it works that way, and I hope it works the other way. I hope when Bucko starts coming out for free online, I hope some people will go, you know what, I don't really read any Marvel comics, but I will go check out what he's doing because I'm enjoying this.
Sure.
And I hope Marvel fans will go, Well, I don't know. It doesn't have the scorpion in it, but okay. I'm going to go read that thing. And a lot of people, we could tell from the reviews, though, we did get a few people that way. We got a lot of people generally like they knew me from Marvel work, so they would come in going, well, I liked Agents of Atlas, or, you know, I liked Exiles or something like that, or X-Men First Class.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, I didn't know what this was going to be like because clearly none of the characters have superpowers as they should. You know, but then they'd read it and go, hey, I was actually entertained, and these were just normal people, and they were written realistically. So, you know, that's what, like, Underground was supposed to be. It was supposed to be a bridge book. It was supposed to be okay, this is the kind of thing we know a lot of you don't like. Steve and I are really into adventure, and we're also into real, ordinary human tales. You know, so, but we can make it a little fantastic, and we can push the envelope of what's possible, you know, without stretching credulity too much. And hopefully there's some common ground we can all meet on here. So, yeah, I think we're slowly finding an audience that way. And obviously the 4chan brinksmanship helped a lot to get us there. You know, but as Steve explained to people online, it's like it would be a mistake to think 4chan is a place to go start opening Starbucks, you know.
Oh, no.
But, yeah, you don't go in and go, hey, 4chaners, I'm here to talk and blah, 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 here's my book. No, they'll just attack you and bring your site down and stuff, you know. It's like Steve played with fire and did it well, and I like the way he described himself. I was like a patient with a head injury, and the locals patched me up and sent me on my way. And that was a great way to describe it.
Sure.
I think he's doing himself a disservice. Steve's actually very good at talking to people online. You know, he's very prudent and just generally likable when he does that sort of thing.
Yeah,
it worked out. But it is one of those things you can't repeat. And I don't think you can draw a lesson from it saying piracy's okay. I'm not condemning it, but I'm also not saying it necessarily will help you make sales.
And you mentioned X-Men First Class, and it occurs to me that a movie is being made of that name.
Yeah.
And, are you just another casual observer? I don't know where Fox's deals are with Marvel, how much they really, you know, how much Marvel really gets a hand in what they're doing.
Yeah, one of the guys from Sony has talked to me, but there's been no formal thing to say, hey, Parker, come out here and tell us what we're doing right, you know, or anything like that. And they didn't buy me a car. I'm a little...
Sorry.
I'm upset about that. I was kind of hoping for, you know, some kind of Audi or something.
Understood.
No. It's still, I'm looking forward to it just like anybody else. It's kind of funny because, you know, they're showing a thing where it looks like they're all in the 60s. I'm like, I would love to have done that.
That's but, cool. I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah, but it's like, hey, look, everybody's walking around in go-go boots and stuff. It's like, oh, man, I love that. But that's exactly the kind of thing, you know, we weren't supposed to do. We were supposed to keep it timeless. So I'm kind of curious to see how that works out.
Yeah, and honestly, moving forward, it will be interesting because it's the X-Men, Daredevil, and Fantastic Four, as far as I know, at Fox. Spider-Man has Sony, or Sony has Spider-Man also, you know, sewed up and everything.
And Disney's going, why the hell did we buy this company and all these products are tied?
It is like
everything we own is tied up with these different studios. What's going on?
It is like getting a deck of cards and suddenly realizing, hey,
like someone did,
some
yeah,
of the face cards
did,
are missing, man.
Someone didn't do their job reporting to us right before we made this enormous purchase.
Who don't we have? Is that important? All right, I don't like that.
Exactly. And that's how this is going to benefit me, because eventually they're going to end up with, they got nothing to use, they're going to make an Agents of Atlas TV show.
Yay.
And I'm going to be sitting pretty.
God, that would be awesome. Wouldn't that be great?
That would be awesome. I think it would translate really well. It probably won't happen, but it's like, I think it's a concept the public can get easily. Hey, here's a bunch of characters from the 50s, they're back. It's not really hard to digest.
Well, you can even do the intelligence thing, too, and kind of make Atlas like... the bad guy organization in Alias.
Well, sure.
You know? I mean, that's the thing. You could do a modern-day, like, evil empire and make it very, very much modern and stuff, but when you get right down to it, Sydney was fighting chaos in Alias. I mean, that's essentially what it was.
Yeah. Bernie Capel.
Exactly.
We can get Bernie Capel in there.
Siegfried.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing I would love to work on, because it'd be so easy to strip the continuity out of it and have it all still work.
Sure.
You know, the whole thing of a robot and a talking gorilla and a love goddess, it doesn't really require being that connected to these other things.
This is true. Well, you got to have that conversation with Loeb, man. Got to make that happen.
Yeah, come on, Loeb. Do me a solid.
Let's go, man.
I mean,
man.
Sure, thanks for recommending me to take over your book. But come on, what have you done for me lately, Loeb?
I am like, I'm excited. I'm excited about David Icke and Guillermo del Toro talking about the Hulk. It's like, okay, I'm waiting.
Yeah, well, that kind of makes perfect sense.
It's interesting. I hope it comes through. I hope it's not just a pie-in-the-sky thought. And that.
When I think del Toro, it's like, come on, can't he do a Doctor Strange movie? That would be awesome.
Ooh, I'd be all for that.
Oh, God, just imagine. That would be so cool.
No, and I really, you know, the last animated movie, I thought, showed how you can do Stephen Strange in the modern era and do it just fine. So, no, I think, you know, and I love what's going on with him in the Marvel Universe right now. Mm-hmm. So, love Doctor Strange.
Oh, and we've got him coming up in Thunderbolts, too. So.
Oh, excellent. Fantastic, man. Very cool.
We got a lot of magic coming up. It's going to be really fun.
Very good. And much like M11, that's, you know, Man-Thing is kind of your, you know, swamp-based Man-11 in terms of being that.
It really is. It's like, I love having it. And again, another character who doesn't say anything, he just acts. And you don't know what he's going to do. And, you know, I feel like there's a way to approach that, which is like, you don't just have him be random, but what they do has to make sense later. You have to look back and go, okay, I see why they did that.
Right,
and okay. And if you know Man-Thing's very basic little working manual, you know, you'll get a kind of sense of the way he's going to behave. He doesn't like fear, and he tends to burn things that are afraid. It's not real hard with him.
Understood.
And he likes blondes, and that's about, you know, that's kind of his thing.
We were talking before we got going, started recording. I mentioned that I was watching Casino Royale, and being the Bond fan that you are, we were talking about how it's so ridiculous that might be it for Daniel Craig as James Bond, because
that is ridiculous. I can't believe that. It's like, make something happen, and come on, MGM. What's this? You're in trouble. You can't afford to make a movie, but if you made this movie, which is a guaranteed seller, you'd be out of trouble. There's got to be, come on, somebody's got to float them some money or something.
Well, or you would think that would even be the bargaining chip, too, to whoever wants to buy the assets and stuff and say, look, you know, buy it and, like, make this Bond movie happen and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, that's just so messed up. MGM's been in that position in the past, too.
This is true, going back when they, you know, were auctioning off the entire studio and stuff, and
yeah,
Dorothy's Red Slippers and everything.
The Culver Studios over where I used to work when I worked on for the Sony lot, really, now. And, you know, it's when I worked on Big Guy and Rusty cartoon, I would always drive through the Culver Studios and think, hey, there's all the MGM stuff. Neat.
Have I ever asked you, did you ever talk to Darrow and tell him that you worked on Big Guy and Rusty?
No, I don't think I've ever seen him in a show.
Well, if you come to Chicago.
There's been a big long line, and I'm like, I hate lines. I'm not going to stand in that line.
That's fine.
And I don't feel like, I don't like the thing of pulling rank and going, pardon me, I'm going to walk behind the table because I can. I just always feel like that's kind of not cool, so I tend to not do that.
That's respectful.
Unless somebody owes me some money and I've got to go up and say, hey.
That's fair. No,
yeah,
man.
You got to come. Hey, Mike Mignola, you owe me money.
You got to come to the Chicago shows.
Yeah,
man.
I don't know. I don't know where the scenario where Mike Mignola owes me money is, but I like the idea.
I like the sound of it. Absolutely.
Yeah, it sounds great because he can pay.
Yes, clearly.
I've had two movies out.
I think so. Absolutely. No, Darrow's been at the last couple of Chicago shows, and he was in New York. Where the fuck were you, man?
I know. Where was I? I'm gonna get back into it next year.
Back on the boat, man. You were
2011. I'm gonna be.
Are you really?
Everywhere.
Where are you
going to
be?
2011. Strangely, I'm appearing at two Wizard shows early in 2011, which I haven't been to a Wizard show in forever. But now that they seem to be not trying to just muscle in on territory, I'm like, okay, yeah, if you're just going to put on a show and it's not hurting anybody else's business or, you know, or anything like that.
Well,
I'm there.
Geographically, I guess. But, yeah, aren't you doing like a March show right after C2E2?
I can't remember what it is. I commit to a lot of things, John, and I I don't think about it till a few weeks until it's about to happen. And I just know I'm going to Toronto, and one of the big ones there was like, oh, yeah, I never go to Toronto. I want to go to Toronto, and I keep meaning to go to TCAF, and I keep not going to that. So I feel like there's Canadian readers, and I need to talk to them. So I want to go there, and then the next one will be down in Anaheim.
Okay.
So that'll give me a chance to go down and see a bunch of my old L.A. friends, run around, go check in on everybody, see what they're up to, do some meetings and stuff. And, you know, maybe if I can work it right, I can take the kids to Disneyland or something like that.
Very cool. And you, but, you know, nothing. So two Canadian shows in Anaheim and, you know, nothing.
No, just one Canadian show. It's just the one.
Oh, excuse me. So Toronto and then Anaheim. Okay.
Toronto show. And then I'm always at Emerald City.
Okay.
I'm trying to always be at Heroes Con in Charlotte. I love that show. That show you shun all the time. I don't know why.
No, I was going to say I might actually see you this year at Heroes Con because.
You're going to love that show. I'm telling you. That's like one of the greatest shows in the country.
I have no doubt. It's just that I think in years past, I would like fill up my spring and then be like, all right, let me wait until San Diego or late summer. But this year, I think I'm going
to
do the opposite.
You're going to get to where I know it's important for you to do San Diego and stuff, but you're going to be so happy because you go to one of those shows or like the Baltimore show and everything, and you get so much quality time with everybody you want to talk to. And it's like, how come this magically works here and not other places? But it does.
That's true. No, I understand that. And I did see that at Baltimore in 2009, and I saw that even at WonderCon in 2009.
WonderCon's a good show.
Yeah. So, no, I really want to go to Heroes Con. And unfortunately, Seattle's too close to C2E2, some of these other shows. So I'm not – it looks like I think Heroes might be the best one to go to after C2E2 for me. So.
Uh-huh.
But you won't be in Chicago, I'm sorry.
When's C2E2?
It's St. Patrick's Day weekend, the 18th through the 20th.
Holy hell, St. Patrick's Day, there's a time to be in Chicago.
Well, it's right after. I mean, you know, and we're traditional. We actually do it on the day. They don't wait for the weekend. It's the 17th. I don't care if it's a Thursday. I'm off.
John, I don't know if I can deal with that many Chi-Town drunks coming up to me.
Well, they'll all be hungover on Friday.
Barfing
all right.
Green stuff all over me. No way, man. Screw that.
No.
I don't know. I might go because I love Chicago. And
good.
Yeah, I haven't been to the town in a while because it's just been whatever with my schedule. It's just been a bad time every time. But I miss Chicago badly.
Yeah, it's been a long time, man.
I wish they'd have it in the dead of winter because, man,
well,
nothing like a Chicago snow, is it?
Well, I was going to say, it being in the middle of March, there's a good chance it might still be winter in Chicago. I mean,
that's true. It might. It probably would be, actually.
We have snow opening day at Wrigley Field, man, in April, so it's not impossible.
Yeah, it's always funny when you're there in the summer and you see those snow signs talking about or this level of snow is going to be. If it's up to this point, it's like, oh, God. Chicago, man, it's freezing 6 months a year, and then it goes straight to sweltering heat, and you never get a spring or anything.
It's true.
You get a couple of weeks of spring, but that's about it.
Well, and you get a late summer. I mean, that's the thing. The warm weather does.
You get a late summer.
Because really, like, fall gets shortchanged, too, but that just means you get more summer. So that's kind of nice.
Well, hopefully climate change will change Chicago a little bit. the people will finally get the fall and the spring that they've deserved for so many years.
That's why I double up on my aerosol cans. That's what I'm pushing the city towards, that inevitability.
Yeah, it's just a good thing they've got trains, just like London. Like, yeah, they're using the hell out of those trains now, aren't they? Because that's the only way they're getting out.
Jesus.
Yeah, the trains never stop for snow. They laugh at it.
God. All right, have we missed anything? Have you got anything else coming up in the early part of the year that you'd like to promote?
Let's see. There's something I've talked about doing with Oni, with an artist I don't think anybody knows yet, but I'm going to wait a little bit on that because I just now started writing it. So I don't want to – I'll drain the magic out of it if I go ahead and start talking about it.
Fair enough.
Let's see. Obviously, all my Marvel stuff. And I'm in talks with doing something for DC, and it's still too early to talk about that, too. So, yeah, that's probably – we probably covered everything unless we just want to just talk about theory or something.
How about theory?
Know, yeah, theory is always good. You know, it's I was almost about to run out and watch True Grit before I talked to you.
Oh, that's so right. Have you seen it or no?
No.
Neither have I, so that's fine. I haven't seen it yet either, so we can hold off on that.
I can't wait. Even though it was kind of funny because a lot of people were talking about, well, why would they bother to make it? It's like, if you go back and watch the John Wayne movie, it's not that good. It's okay.
That's so funny. Somebody else was telling – Fraction was shitting on – well, it's easy to shit on Kim Darby, don't get me wrong. But, you know – but yeah, Fraction even we were talking about it, and he, you know, brought it, and he's like, "Ah, Glenn Campbell," and I'm like, "Oh, come on!" I'm like, "They were, that's who was there. What are you gonna do?"
He was Glenn Campbell, all right.
At least he wasn't
funny,
Fabian.
Funny how he didn't stick with the acting that much after a couple of years.
This is true.
But, and yet, Kris Kristofferson abandoned music. Maybe that was the trade-off. Maybe they went.
Interesting.
Maybe they were like these two ships, and they switched places. Like, I'm going to go into movies, and you go into music. It's kind of funny, though, because if you had to pick a modern Glenn Campbell, Matt Damon kind of works, you know.
Oh, totally.
Thinking that way. But, yeah, no, the original True Grit, if I don't think a lot of people actually saw it or they've forgotten it by now, but it's really just a lot like these other kind of comedy westerns like Sons of Katie Elder and stuff that Wayne was doing at the time. Except it doesn't have Dean Martin like Sons of Katie Elder did, which is awesome.
I know. Isn't it cool how, like, he and Sinatra made these westerns, like, in the 60s? It's like, really?
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing, pal?
It's so funny. You go and watch them, and you watch them, and, yeah, you can't buy Sinatra at all, but Dean Martin does a pretty – for some reason, you buy Dean Martin. It's like,
What's the one with him and Jimmy Stewart where they're brothers?
Oh, God. Come on now. What is that?
Is it Shenandoah? No.
Is it?
No, maybe not. All right, we'll look it up. I'll look it up while we're talking.
Oh, it's just, yeah. And whatever, and almost all of those, it's like Dean Martin's totally plausible.
Because I'm still rolling. We could use this, actually, if you want.
Yeah,
I'm still
use it, because Dean Martin was, that man was gold no matter what you put him in.
Well, you know, Sinatra.
He's funnier than Jerry Lewis. All the time. That's how you can always tell the funny people. They're not afraid to be straight men.
Sure.
Because all they care about is getting the laugh. They don't give a rat's ass whether they get it from... If they're a true artist, they don't care whether they thought they attracted it or not. All they care about is that it happened. And I think that was the legacy of Dean Martin, that he really was that way. All he cared about was everybody got entertained.
Bandolero, by the way.
Bandolero.
With Raquel Welch.
Damn, I want to watch that right now.
I'm telling
actually.
You.
I forgot about that.
Well, you know, hey, God bless Encore Western, because they show all that stuff all the time.
Can you beat Dean Martin, Jimmy Stewart, and Raquel Welch?
He's my brother, you see. Hey, I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah.
Really? Wow.
I think we all, at the studio, we always get into a conversation, and Lieber and I will talk about Man Who Shot Liberty Valance to everybody, because we love that movie.
I love that movie. Absolutely.
It's my favorite John Ford movie. My dad and I used to argue about it or whatever. And, you know, he'd say The Searchers was the best John Ford movie. And we'd finally agree on, it's like, okay, we'll say The Searchers is the best John Wayne movie, but Liberty Valance is the best John Ford movie or whatever, even though John Wayne's in both of them, and he's really good in both of them. You know, his part's kind of small, but it's pretty awesome in Liberty Valance.
Yeah, but he is the catalyst of the movie. I mean, it's Jimmy Stewart's story, but
he's the driving force. It was a really interesting thing, the way it plays off of politics.
Oh, absolutely.
And stuff. You
territory
know,
versus statehood, absolutely.
Yeah, and it talks about a kind of a new liberal order, which is represented by Jimmy Stewart, and yet this very conservative kind of hawk sort of thing, which is John Wayne. But you still need John Wayne, because he is the man who shot Liberty Valance. Spoilers, sorry, everybody. Or whatever. But, you know, you still got to have him. You need both.
Absolutely.
That's the kind of magic of that story, and that's great. That's just great writing.
Well, that's what I love about Mississippi Burning, which isn't as good of a movie, but I do still defend it. And there's a lot wrong with that movie, but what I do kind of like that same idea of – here comes the new wave and the liberal wave. But it's like, yeah, but you really do need, going back to what we were talking about, too, what we like about John Wayne movies and Colonel Ty and Battlestar Galactica. You need that crusty old man that represents the old way that can still pull your idealistic ass out when the the fire's about to end things.
And that's Ross in the Hulk.
Yes.
Like, yeah, you kind of resent him, but at the same time, it's like, hey, we really need some ass kicked over here. As I remember, you're kind of good at that. And and that's what he does. He comes in and owns everybody, and he knows exactly how to do it.
That's fun.
Yeah, I just love that stuff. God, no. John Ford was so good. John Ford was also great because he was one of those completely deceitful people about what he was doing. You know, he'd act like, no, we're just out to entertain. We're not trying to make a statement here. Bullshit, you were too. You're just that good that you could do it.
One of my favorite quiet John Ford movies is The Last Hurrah.
Oh, yeah.
Spencer Tracy movie. I love that movie.
And somebody like him would know how to work with somebody like Spencer Tracy, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and has the gravitas to where he respects him. And it's interesting because I had no idea that they both were intimate with Katharine Hepburn, and Ford was Katharine Hepburn's boyfriend years before Tracy.
Yeah, that had to make some good times on the set right there.
Have you seen that
also,
Turner?
Also, that she wasn't supposed to be fooling around with Tracy at the time either.
Right, given that Tracy was married, that's true.
Well, yeah.
But have you seen that documentary? It was, I want to say, about Ford. And they have this audio that Ford's son, like, he recorded them for his memoirs or something, and it was like an audio tape of them just reminiscing about the old days. And he let the tape go, and they didn't know it. And, like, Ford was dying. He was in his bedroom and was, you know.
He's just spilling his guts.
Yeah. And at one point leaves, and he's like, to Katharine, he's like, you know, it was really good of you to come here. And suddenly you get, like, 30 seconds of a real conversation between them. And she's like, well, of course I was going to come. And it's not, you know, they're not reading from a script, and they don't know they're on tape. And it's really sad, and it's, you can tell they're both saying goodbye to each other. And it's like, and it's these two lovers saying goodbye to each other. And it's like,
That's just going to choke me up. I got the same. At the same time, I love when someone manages to catch that sort of thing.
Sure. No, it was incredible. And yeah, his son apparently did it. It's in this Richard Schickel, John Ford documentary that they showed on Turner Classic Movies. Did you see the miniseries of that media or Movies and Moguls on TCM?
No, I wanted to. A lot of people were talking about it, and I wanted to see that. And of course, since I almost never get to see TV or whatever, till years after the fact, I still have not.
I hope that they put it on DVD. I can't think why they wouldn't, because it really is great. And, you know, that's a non-comics convention I'd be interested in seeing. Is it really sounds like they're having very cool happenings with Turner in L.A. in the spring, where they do a big kind of movie convention and actually have these seminars where, I know last year, even Marie Saint.
High time they did something like that.
No kidding, and it's a shame that they waited too long because, yeah, a lot of great people.
Yeah, you've lost a lot of good people who could, they weren't doing anything. They could have totally come out, remembered some things for you, met an appreciative public. Yeah.
No, it is. I mean, well, and you know, honestly, that's one of the reasons why I started Word Balloon, and I want to have more of the old timers on while they're still around, because you do. It's really great to get it firsthand from the people who were there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, I'm going to talk to Blake Bell secondhand about Bill Everett in a few
better
weeks.
Better nothing, you know. It's,
right?
Oh,
absolutely. And there's some wonderful books coming out like that right now.
Yeah, it always shocks me how much a lot of those people can remember too. And I guess it's one of the magic things or whatever. A lot of times you ask people in their twilight years, that's when their long-term memory really kicks in, and suddenly they can remember it very clear.
True.
Toth is always the one, you know, you go through and read the stuff, and I just can't believe it. It's like, how the hell can he remember all this stuff?
Letters from John, the book that you guys edited?
Yeah. You read through there, and he's just pouring so much detail, plus the fact that he's writing it. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that he's writing it by hand. You know, but he's remembering so many things, like, yeah, blah, blah. I knew Irwin Hazen when, he's going back to New York in the 40s, and I can't remember something that happened 5 years ago. How do you remember that? And but maybe that's part of being that sort of artist or whatever. You absorb detail in that way. But I think a lot of it is later in life, a lot of that stuff starts kicking back to the surface.
I agree.
It's like, and hope to God somebody like you was there running up with a nice omnidirectional microphone to get all this.
You know what I just bought?
Our Skype.
Yes.
Are an unreliable computer of Skype.
Yeah, we tried to do this on Skype for about 15 minutes and gave
up. That was a laugh, yeah.
That's okay. That's all right. Someday we will do a Skype
John
interview.
Saying, can you hear me? Me screaming and John not hearing anything.
You know what I bought for myself, it being my birthday and Christmas month, the Will Eisner DVD that just came out from Tomorrow's. Or rather, not from Tomorrow's, from Comic Book Artists, because I know that the two have split since... they were together, but it's a great DVD, and as a bonus, they have the audio interviews that Eisner did for Shop Talk on the DVD.
Wow, that's a sweet package.
It's incredible, and you've got Gil Kane, Harvey Kurtzman, Joe Kubert from the early 80s, Milton Caniff, Terry and the Pirates. I mean, these guys talking firsthand of what it was like, and it's incredible, incredible. Phil Suling.
Sold. I will be buying that.
It's amazing, and it really is just this bonus feature, and it's the reason why I bought the thing even more than the documentary itself. And the documentary is very good.
Gil Kane's going to remember everything, as far as I can tell.
Exactly.
He's one of those, my boy. And he'll just say, my boy, and it'll all come rolling out, and he'll remember it exactly.
The Comics Journal had this great Gil Kane, Robert Crumb panel from a convention, and that was really interesting.
I love stuff like that. Yeah,
I agree. Oh, no. And, you know, Dan Close was just at, I forget what, Small Press show, and he was talking about being on a panel with a bunch of his contemporaries like Gilbert Hernandez and Crum, and then Bern Hogarth was there, but Bern Hogarth was pissed and not happy to be associated with these guys. I don't know where
you guys
are coming from. You suck.
I'm sure Hogarth was like, what are these little bums doing here? Whatever. Everybody hated Hogarth. He was like, you know, Al Williamson would just, I tried to ask him about him. He was like, eh.
Really?
He clearly, like, you know, he went to school under Bern Hogarth when he was a teenager. And Hogarth, not an easy man to get along with, and generally just wanted to talk about how great he was all the time.
Jesus.
So, he was the self-appointed Michelangelo of comics, John.
But he's a guy whose talent was there. I mean, it's not like he sucked and was being an asshole.
No. That's a big difference. I have much more time for someone who's actually good,
and it's still
a gigantic, crazy ego. But then what you usually get is bums who are absolutely no good who still think they're the Michelangelo of comics.
Absolutely.
You know, at least Hogarth had something going on. I don't think Al ever warmed up to him, and probably because you know he was telling him to draw like him, and he didn't want to. He wanted to draw like Alex Raymond.
What was your association with Al Williamson? I didn't know you knew him well.
I didn't know him that great. You know, so my friend Mark Schultz, of course, was good friends with him. But
absolutely. I didn't know you and Mark were friends. That's cool.
I met Mark because of Al. Al was, I wrote this stuff online last year when he died, just trying to get out some of my thoughts while I could still all remember everything. But Al was incredibly important to me as a young artist, and because... When I was sort of in college and I wasn't sure how serious I was about comics, you know, I was drawing them and everything. I'd do them for the newspaper and I'd work with friends on stories and go around and show at conventions. And then John Hitchcock, who owns Parts Unknown in Greensboro, North Carolina, was running the Acme Comic Convention. And he was big into the EC guys, and he had Al Williamson and all these guys come down, like George Evans and stuff like that. And I went to that show, you know, I drove down from Greenville, it was like a 3-hour drive or something, and took my art up to Al, and you know, finally when I got a chance and Al looked over and saw what I was doing, he invited me to come back and sit behind the table with him. And I almost crapped myself, you know, I was like, what? I was so happy. He actually really didn't get much time to talk to me because people were dropping Daredevil after Daredevil into his lap for him to sign. And by the way, let me do an aside to people. Okay, look, I understand you're fans of a guy, especially like someone venerable like Al Williamson or whoever's worked in the medium a long time. Don't make him sign 60 books, people.
Yeah, really.
Take your five favorite books up there and say, here, sign these. Because what is it you want out of this? You know, don't you really want to just interact with the person? And I think a lot of people are thinking, well, I just want as much time in front of them as possible, so I'm going to sit in these stacks of books. It's like, yeah, and they worked in the industry that long, they're going to have a lot to sign. I would never do that. I always just took like two or three of my favorite books up to them, and often I would have them sign on a page that had a panel I really, you know, always meant a lot to me or I liked a lot, you know. It's like I wasn't going to sell these books anyway, you know.
Right.
It wasn't like they weren't going to eBay. They didn't have eBay then anyway. So, you know, so when people will plop them down in front of me, and I'll kind of try to gently ask them, it's like, do you really need me to sign all these? I mean, it's like, I'll do it. You know, but why do you want them all signed? And it's kind of an OCD thing, which I sort of understand because I'm kind of like that too, where it's like, oh, I like all these things, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I think they just need them all signed for some reason. And, like, I'm just saying, putting this idea out there, you don't have to do that. you could just get them to sign your favorite book or something. And instead of having them spend their whole time there wearing their hand out, you could ask them some questions. You know, and it's just like when you're going to, if you meet a movie star and it's like you get to spend a little time with them, don't ask for their autograph. Who gives a shit about that? You know, just appreciate the time you're with them. You
Absolutely.
Know, maybe ask them a question you've always wanted to ask and maybe they'll answer it.
Yep.
I just don't get it. I mean, you're around a lot of famous people. You talk to a lot of famous people. So, you know, you would never dare ask for something like that.
No, I in fact, you know, when I buy sketches, artists are like, you know, John, I'd do something for you for free. And I'm like, oh, well, okay. I really wasn't even thinking of that. I think I enjoy the time that we spend just talking and stuff. I wouldn't think of, like, asking you for an autograph or a sketch or anything like that. I'm just happy to meet you and get the moment of having the conversation, getting the questions
like
answered.
Don't waste what you can really
right.
get out of the meeting. Don't waste it on signatures. Who cares? You got Al Williamson's name on one thing. You got it. You don't need it on 50 books. Anyway,
no.
So everybody's there dropping piles on them. I'm not really getting to talk to them. But at the same time, I'm sitting there as this kid behind the table sitting next to Al Williamson. And I'm on the... To me, that's a... I'll use this because someone on Twitter told me, hey, use the phrase paradigm shift. That's a paradigm shift for me because I am suddenly going from one world on that side of the table to this side of the table. And as I described it online, it was like, I don't know if Chuck Yeager ever invited you to go up into the Bell X1 with him, but that's what it felt like to me. I was just like, oh, my God. It didn't really matter that Al didn't get a chance to talk to me that much, you know. It's like that shifted my mind, and from that point on, I'm working in comics.
Awesome.
You know, it's like I'm going to make it happen. It's like this guy, who is a living legend, thought it was okay to let me come sit back behind this table, you know. So from that point when I got back, oh, man, I was writing and drawing like crazy. I was just burning through pages. You know, it's like I was like, I've got a destiny. So anyway, it was extremely important to me. And, you know, and when he finally got a little chance, Al just told me, he's like, draw from life more or whatever. You know, but then he said, come up, and if you get a chance, come up and visit me up in Pennsylvania. And so the next morning, my friend Micah and I, next summer, planned out a trip and everything, put some time together and wrote to him and all that. And then also wrote to Mark Schultz because Al had said, hey, I can probably get Mark Schultz to come over. I don't know if he reads Cenozoic Tales. And it's like, yeah, he's great. You know, he had really just been doing that for a year or so. And I like that Al's way of, like, I'll just make him come over because Mark has to do whatever I say, which is kind of beautiful. But, you know, instead we wrote and didn't hear from Mark because why would he write back some punks from a college? And but then when I drove up there, I pulled over somewhere in Pennsylvania and called them and said, hey, we're kind of near. And this is such a weird thing. I would never do this now. You know, I thought it was just okay to just call cartoonists and say, can I come by? And and Mark said, yeah, that'd be totally fine. But that's, you know, you got to think about it. That's the way fandom was back then. It was very piecemeal and just put together any way you could get it. You know, it wasn't like this. Everybody's got a Facebook and fan
Twitter.
Page and a Twitter account.
Right.
And you can go interact with them this way. There it was just like, hey, maybe you'll see him at a show. Maybe you can write to him. You know, who knows? And then we went over there and met Mark and his wife, Denise, and they were, you know, the best people in the world and hung out for the evening and then took off and then went to Al's house the next day. And it was just a extremely memorable trip. You know, it was of course, stayed in touch with Mark ever since then. He and I always have a good time when we see each other. And, you know, it was just, there's no, I really can't express how important to me it was to go hang out with Al and really what he did for me. And just a very, very simple gesture, which to him, he probably couldn't even remember. You know, but to me, it meant everything. So, yeah, it was a pretty big deal. And we certainly lost a luminary this year.
Yeah, it was pretty sad. I immediately, it's funny, I had just spoken to Mark the week before it happened. And so I felt almost embarrassed about it, but I asked him, I said, gee, I'd like to release it almost as a tribute to Al. I mean, because we only spent about 15 minutes talking about Al, but he had so many great things to say. And my God, those books are so wonderful that that Mark did. The Flash Gordon book turned out so great. And mm-hmm. and really the work that he's doing with Flesk as they continue to put out those Art of Al sketchbooks and everything are just fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Flesk has got my money for the foreseeable future. They are totally putting out things I want.
You know? In addition to, Mark II coming out, I'm so glad that Big Z and Azoic just came out. It's just beautiful. It really is. And I'm looking forward to Storms at Sea.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be very cool. And also, Flesk has another one of my pals, Gary Gianni, who's a good guy.
Gary. And he and Mark do the Prince Valiant strip together.
Yep. So,
and if you haven't been watching it, which I don't blame you. It's like, who pays attention to Prince Valiant anymore after many years? But you probably didn't realize that they breathed new life into it and been doing some really good stuff. I think comics fandom always kind of poo-pooed Prince Valiant for the simple reason that it was narrated text and not word balloons. That's always been my feeling about that, why like Alex Raymond was embraced by the comics public more than Foster was.
I can appreciate that.
He did Flash Gordon. Flash Gordon was also the same way, but then after that, it was all word balloons.
Right.
And, and there's just something more immediate about the character having this balloon with words going to their mouth that makes you feel like it's happening, and the other seems more removed. And it's weird. Seems kind of respectful and yet ancient and not as active and all the things that kind of make you put it up on a pedestal and away from you and not into your inner sphere of experiencing something.
Well, and I know I get teased about loving, being so nostalgic as I am of older things, but my God, comic strips really are incredible. And when you go back to the old, classic runs of Raymond, not only on Flash, but like Rip Kirby. I'm really getting into Rip Kirby now.
Oh, that stuff's so good. Especially now you can get the really well done things Dean Mullaney's been doing.
At IDW, yes.
At IDW. And it's like, oh, great. Because for years, all we could get were these I don't want to run Tony Rayola down for those prints that he did, but he's shooting them from newspapers half the time, and it's hard in there, and they're touching up the lettering, and it looks kind of crappy.
Sure.
But that was the only way you could get it for a long time.
Right.
I still thought they were great. And Tony was a good guy. But probably still is. But Dean Mullaney's really, he's kind of created this whole, something to take my money, because he's just putting out these books with these beautiful reprints, a little extra information, all this stuff. And everything is just, it's kind of unequaled right now. It's a very golden age of reprints.
And the level of sophistication in the storytelling. I mean, the art is incredible. Obviously, these are the masters. These are the guys that I need to always remind some of my brethren in podcasting. And they say, why weren't the golden age comic book creators held in better regard? It's like, because they were in the basement. The guys that were living in the penthouse were the guys that had these syndicated comic strips. They were, Will Eisner, everybody wanted to be Will Eisner, but Will Eisner wanted to be Milton Caniff.
Exactly. Caniff and Raymond were living large.
Right.
Yeah, if you go look at the pictures and everything, like, ooh, look at the size of that house. You know, there's like, Hal Foster's living up in Canada, up in this just beautiful wood. He's got acres up there, He's doing all right.
Well, in fact, Al
Williamson at a lunch, I went back to visit him years later all by myself. And he was telling me how he got to go up and kind of talk to him.
Talk to Foster?
Because he did the same thing like me where I thought I was overstepping later. But where he just wrote and said, hey, here's my art. Can I come visit? And he said yes.
Wow.
And so Al Williamson went up to visit Raymond. A servant answered the door. Right, John, that's the way comics is supposed to be, by the way. Servants answer the door. Maybe make you a little sandwich while you're
here,
there.
Here.
Something. Okay. So there were servants. I'll let you know that Raymond was not hurting. And he let Al hang out for the afternoon and everything. And then Al didn't want to overstep or anything, but then found out later, if he had just pushed it, that Raymond kind of wanted him to come be an assistant. So he found out that from another friend who worked for him. And it's like, that's the way it is. It's like always finding out, oh, that girl wanted to date you. Why didn't you ask her out?
That's really cool. Jesus.
Yeah, Alex Raymond, Milt Kniff, they were all doing really well. They were what they all wanted to be were newspaper strips.
Right.
And these things were what TV shows would later become, or matinees, because, people were tuning in. They wanted to, all the time, they had to know what was happening in Terry and the Pirates. And the big thing, you read that Terry and the Pirates connection that IDW does, they'll tell you about when you get to the part where Raven Sherman dies. People were losing their minds even more than when the frog died in Thunderbolts. Even more. So people were just, there was letter writing campaigns that just cannot be, and there people are holding vigils, stuff like that. It was important.
Oh, I understand.
They were as into it as people watching Lost and having parties over that, or Twin Peaks or whatever years later.
And also getting respect not only from readers, but also from other creators in other media, because I think you did finally grab it. Did you get that Bogdanovich and Orson Welles? I forget who I was telling about it, but there's the book This Is Orson Welles, and there's an audio version of it. And again, much like the Eisner thing I just described.
No, you did tell me about it, and I didn't get. I'll make a note now.
All right, because somebody I know I was just talking to about it. Oh, maybe it was Fraction, because they found it on a blog and they were able to find the actual audio tape version. Because it's great hearing Bogdanovich interview Welles, but they go on a tangent and talk about comic strips for a while. And Orson Welles says,
Orson knew his stuff, man.
Huge comics fan, and he's like,
I didn't know if Bogdanovich did, but that's neat to know if he did.
Well, I mean, he was really leading Orson in terms of what he liked, but it seemed like he knew what he was talking about. And the best was he talked about Milton Kniff, and he's like, I adored Kniff when he was doing Terry and the Pirates, but when
that's the kind of thing. And now that sets off my total geek thing. I'm like, he knows about Kniff.
He said he had a portrait of the Dragon Lady that Kniff. He commissioned Kniff to make for him. But then he said, then after the war, he started with this Steve Canyon stuff, and he completely lost me. And he said, and he is so distressed at how Milton Kniff's politics changed. And obviously, he completely lost me. I had no idea what he was talking about. And it was just so funny to hear. And he's like, oh, did you like Barney Google? He's like, I knew the real Barney Google. I adored him. He was a wonderful man. And it's just...
oh, God, now I just want to hear nothing but... Peter Bogdanovich talking about cartoonists.
Flash of Two Worlds. What'd you think about that? I was happy to see Jay Garrick come back. That was incredible.
I believe this is where the real idea of Professor Zoom was born. Yeah, God, I've got to hear that. That's just great.
We got to fake that stuff like Miller did when he was supposed that Welles was prepping the Batman movie. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's very cool. Now, you mentioned about Prince Valiant and Hal Foster and the fact that he used text and stuff like that. It was something I wanted to talk about earlier when we were talking about Atlas and you putting in those pages of text. It always makes me laugh when I hear some fans complain about that. That they're like, hey, man, what's with the words? Because I know Hickman has been doing a post-text to a few of his Fantastic Four stories of late as well.
Yeah, and they all get mad.
Yes, and it cracks me up. I think it is so funny that they really get, hey, if I wanted to read, I would have bought a book. And that's essentially
what... I go to the library,
exactly.
Hickman. Yeah,
you got too much book in my comic book, man.
It's weird, because in my mind, I always assumed, well, the comics readers are also just big prose readers.
You would think.
And a lot of them are, but apparently there's a few that aren't, and they only want comics things. Steve Lieber was talking about some guy he went to the Kubert School with who would only read comics-related material that they all used to give him hell, and I don't remember who it was, and I wouldn't out him now anyway if I did know who the guy was. But so, yeah, apparently any book the guy had to be, well, this is Superman trivia or something like that. It's like, really, can't you just read a book? You know, just like, you know, like Huck Finn, something like that? You know, no. Answer is no.
At least he's reading.
I don't quite get it. I love occasionally when I actually use my blog as a place other than to just pimp my wares. I'll occasionally ask people what they're reading, and everybody comes back with really good stuff, you know. And I'll get a great reading list from people because they're really engaged and they know what's out there. And they're not reading Jonathan Frey; they're really reading real stuff, John. For those of you who don't know, Jonathan Frey was that liar who was on Oprah.
James Frey.
I can't think of a better way to.
James Frey.
James Frey, sorry.
That's okay.
And we were talking about Hickman, but Jonathan was still stuck in. Thanks, Hickman, screwing me up on that.
No, but I want to talk about that for a second because I am number four, you are number four or whatever the hell. Do you know about this?
Hmm?
Do you know about this science fiction movie that's coming out that's based on a James Frey book?
Oh, God, no.
It's like...
No, you're just making this up, right?
No, this is totally real, and we are, I think, weeks away from it coming out.
Jesus.
It's already being billed potentially by, I'm sure, the people who are the Spinmeisters as the next Twilight in genre fiction because it's kind of sappy romance.
Oh, of course, he smelled a buck.
But it's like it's put Twilight meets Roswell because it's aliens who live among us who are pretty teenagers. And I think it's called You Are Number Four.
I may have to go kill somebody.
I understand. And James Frey is one of the co-writers of the concept. And it's...
Is this one of those things where he offered his deal that, hey, you come to me and I'll make you a star and blah, blah, blah? Whatever this thing is he's trying to do with young writers where he brings them in and makes all the connections for them and then he ends up somehow magically getting all the money or something.
Oh, I have no idea. I don't even know about that backstory.
Yeah, there's this big, long article online right now where you can read more about it.
That's creepy.
Ooh, it's creepy.
God, what an asshole.
I hope Oprah gets after his ass again.
No shit.
Go on, Oprah. Scream at him some more. Make him cry.
That was the best public spanking. My nephew read his book and, like, the attic book and really was like, oh, my God, this guy's incredible. And I really felt bad for the kid when it turned out that the thing
I bet your nephew was pissed.
Well, and you know something? And now I'm safe to ask him about it. But, yeah, it was really like when he was, like, a junior or senior in high school that he read it.
Yeah,
now he's in college, so I do want to look back and go, yeah, dude, what do you think of that whole thing?
That is about the age you would be taken in by something like that. I was reading it. I remember at the time I was reading a review of it, and the guy figured out really fast it was all bullshit. He was like, there's no way. Oh, yeah, this mafia guy and all these tough guys crying in front of you, and you're their pal. Yeah, bullshit. You know, it's like the reviewer knew it was just nothing right away. He's like, I can tell fiction from reality. I've been in reality some. So that was kind of neat. And then the guy just still keeps going on. And
yeah, I had no idea. And that's the thing. I hadn't really heard about him since the de-pantsing on Oprah.
Yeah, and in this big, long article explaining about his agency deal or whatever, he says something like, yeah, I saw Norman Mailer right before he died and said, you were the last one of us. Like, Norman Mailer did not say that.
Yeah, bullshit. Oh, my
God. Yeah, what a jerk the guy is.
Now, speaking of Mailer, you know, that's a piece of tape I'm looking for, is of that famous Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, Lillian Hellman appearance on the Dick Cavett Show. Do you know about this? Where they like?
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Where you need a dictionary and a thesaurus next to you to kind of follow the shit that's being flung at each other. It's the most intellectual, like, fight of words that you've ever heard.
Uh-huh.
I love that. And I've only seen, like, 30 seconds of it. I'm like, I want the whole goddamn thing, man. And even, like, Cavett getting pissed off at Mailer. Oh, it was awesome.
Good old Dick Cavett just having the front row seat to everything like that.
He had the nerve to do that on my show.
And now here's George Harrison to just come smile at me. It's funny, now my kid's in here trying to get something out of me, but you were just making me think, because we just all read the Harry Potter books together.
Oh, and?
Yeah, so, I had already read them.
Okay.
I read them as they came out, but it was kind of neat going back and rereading them, and you know what? She holds up even better. It was, I think at the time you'd hear a lot of critics talk about Rowling as if she were what's her name, the Twilight woman.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, and I can't think of her name
right
now. Go ahead.
Anyway, you know, I think a lot of people were the literary world's kind of mad because, hey, somebody came in and made money with books again. You know, it doesn't happen. It becomes a point of pride. It's like, oh, yes, we don't do this for the money. It's like, bullshit, you all want money. You wish you'd have money. And Rowling made something that people really enjoyed. And you go back and read them, they're really well done. She does a lot of things, and it was actually refreshing to me. And I was like going, you know what, there's a lot of things I do in comics that she's doing well here or whatever, and it's neat to see somebody do it and pull it off. And it's that sort of world building and reestablishing things, bringing you back into it. And that's a lot of what monthly comics is. It's kind of like, hey, you know, it's like we're going to surprise you on some things, but for a lot of things, you're here to kind of feel like, hey, it's that old home week. It's my favorite bar. It's the area I like to keep going to. And that's what the readers want out of it, or whatever. You know, you got to subvert their expectations on some things, but in some place make that comfortable seat for them again. And she would actually do that quite a bit. So yeah, I was actually pleasantly surprised to see how well it held up on the second reading.
I guess I'm hearing that she might be coming back with more stories.
Yes, I think she just realized it's like, oh, I've made billions of pounds. And it just occurred to me, I could make more. But no, probably she's just like done a lot of what she's done. She's got time. She's kind of feeling like writing again, as my guess is. So I'm like, well, my kids are ready. I'm ready. Come on, bring it on. You know,
very cool.
My kids have already gotten wind of it. You know, they're 5 and 7, and they're already kind of excited. Like, oh, she's going to write some more. And my daughter's written little things about her and dedicated little short stories she's made to her. It's kind of neat.
That's cute. Have you? Would you want to then follow up with like a Percy Jackson thing or anything like that? Any of those appeal to you? Have you tested any of that stuff out?
I was thinking of I've been just reading. I have read the entire Harry Potter series, except for a few nights when my wife stepped in to read, or whatever. I've been reading it to them in bed, and it's funny how other books read better as just spoken words.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I don't think a lot of people think of. They don't think of how well their stuff is going to read orally.
Sure.
And naturally, it doesn't have to. You know, most people aren't reading that way, aren't having things told to them. But
I got a sponsor that's called Audible.com, though, that, you know, is making a nice little business for itself on audiobooks. So you're right about that, though. I think storytelling. Go on.
Yeah, and she's got a lot of good places that read well in there. And I think when she's thinking about it, she makes effort towards it. I think about it a lot just because what I'm doing is I try to say out what characters are saying, our mumbler, whatever, because, you know, I don't want them to say this mouthful that really wouldn't work. You know, I think there's a little point of believability in a character's dialogue. And the way you break it up and stuff. So I think about that sort of thing a lot, and I appreciate it. And anyway, but back to the kids. I was thinking maybe the next thing I would read would be The Hobbit.
Oh, great.
I thought, yeah, let's try The Hobbit. I don't know if I'm going to throw the whole Lord of the Rings on them yet, but I'll try The Hobbit. That's not too bad.
God, and, that was the first one I read, I mean, as a kid,
yeah,
and everything.
I was certainly into it as a kid.
And I was like 11 or 12. So, yeah, I think that's good for a kid to be, read too.
Yeah, we've read other things like Babe and Charlotte's
nice.
Web and
very
stuff
nice.
Like that.
Classics.
Which, yeah, they're Babe's more modern Charlotte's Web and everything. And, yeah, Babe gets a little harsh in places. But, of course, you know, George Miller made the movie, so what do you expect?
I know when Dez shows up with that mohawk, it all gets freaky.
God, I love it. I love Farmer Hoggett. Oh, I love that stuff. I love good children's fiction. It's just good fiction, and I get pissed off when I see people run it down like it's something easy to write. It's like, yeah, you think it's easy to write? Write some.
You know, I'll expand the circle and include children's comics because.
Oh, definitely children's comics. It's like and you can tell when someone is just treating it like some second-rate medium, and they're going, okay, I'll slum and do this. Like, well, get the hell out. It is hard to write children's comics that are good. You've got to get into a special headspace to pull that off.
I agree. I think, you know, my buddies Art and Franco over at DC.
And, yeah, they know what they're doing.
And Jesse Blaise Snyder, I got to say, his Boom books, his Toy Story books, they are a lot of fun. And I was really surprised. I met him in New York. And, you know.
Yeah, he's done a good job. I've gotten some of those Toy Story books.
They're really good. They really capture the tone of the movie. And they're funny. I thought he did a really good job. I was really stunned.
I think they need to go a little brighter on the coloring. I think someone's looking at it. It's just in that
visually, I agree with that. Yeah, it's a little muted. I agree with that.
It's coming in a little dark, like they're using too much K in the colors. And I think they, but that's totally secondary. The stories work fine. They make me believe I'm in that universe. They're doing a great job. Boom's generally just doing. I mean, the most brilliant thing they did was say, "Here, Roger Langridge, do the Muppets."
No kidding.
You know, Roger just kills. Roger kills at anything. He's, in my mind, one of the best creators working in comics. And at some point, everybody's going to suddenly turn around and look at him like, oh, my God, you're Roger Langridge, and you're working in our industry. And then they're going to realize what they've got. But at the moment, they don't seem to get it.
No, but I do think that whatever is next might be the one finally. Because I do think that the outcry over Thor, and well-deserved, because, I mean, he and Somni did such a beautiful job on the book, and it's such a smart book and accessible. That, you know, and again, his facility for humor in terms of what he did for the Muppets as well. I think he's the real deal. And I think the next thing will, I think, hopefully push him through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Insomni.
He's crazy.
A powerhouse.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to work with him again as soon as I possibly can.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Who brought him to Marvel? Me.
Attaboy. Very nice.
And everybody else immediately go, oh, cool, we won't sign him. Like, hey, wait, man. That's not fair. I brought him to the dance. Piss me off.
I understand.
But, no, I don't care.
Hey, you brought Gabe in, man. That's all right. You're bringing in good guys, man.
Yeah, Martin Fenice and I were all over Gabe once we saw him. We're like, what? Everybody's being crazy. They don't realize what this guy can do. And it's like, we committed Gabe up to, as many years in advance as we could. So that no one could ever work with him.
Well, and they're crazy good, man. They're
I'm going to do that with Chris again next chance I get. That's a dream for me for him and like a Langridge to be working together there's a book I can enjoy. It's like Thor had so much personality. I'm sorry, no one's done that much with Thor, and even Simonson, who I worship. Or whatever, did great stuff, but you didn't get to see like young Thor horsing around, falling in love, all this stuff.
Yes,
it's just beautiful stuff. No. And Somni's got this kind of style that can cover all kinds of. I mean, he adapts it, but he can cover all ranges of stuff. He can go from extremely lighthearted to deadly serious, and it doesn't look that different, and it works. That's not easy to do.
I agree, and I just his illustrative style is just ridiculously beautiful. I have a piece, one piece that kind of even shows that in by itself. It's Dan Dare, and
that's perfect.
It was this 50s Dan Dare, and he's in his 50s sci-fi spacesuit, and he's bending over, looking at these beautiful little hatchlings of like pterodactyl babies, and doesn't realize right behind him there's a giant pterodactyl about to attack him, and it so looks like just this great gold key kind of style illustrative cover and everything. It's absolutely beautiful. I bought that. And then, of course, I had to buy Super Chief because he did this awesome Super Chief. But no, he's amazing. Chris is great.
Well, and that's how he's a true cartoonist. He won't just do a drawing of a character standing there. Chris Omni would never give you some lame-ass shit like that. He is always going to, like, set up a little scenario that's telling a story. And it's like, that's how you can tell a real cartoonist, man. They tell story all the time.
Are you a big Comic Twart fan?
Oh, yeah. I always check out what they do. And, of course, my collaborators like Tom Fowler work on there.
Right.
Francesco Francavilla, he's always doing something awesome on there. It's always a gold key cover takeoff, but I always love it.
No. Francesco's doing great on Black Panther. It's been great to see that. And
it's been nice seeing everybody suddenly become aware of him.
Yep.
That Comic Twart's like, man, I don't even have to pay for this thing. I'm just going in here looking.
No, and it's so cool when they do just kind of just shoot out ideas like, G.I. Robot. And it's like, fantastic. God, just some of the ideas. Or even they did Futurama a few months ago or a couple months ago. And just and Matt Fowler just knocked it out. And really, I mean, God, if anything, Bongo should, like, commission that from him and, like, run off prints of it, because it would be this, like, easily this beautiful poster that people would want in their homes.
Fowler's incredible, too, because he can paint a picture as fast as everybody else can draw one with ink. So to him, it's just like, well, I got these paints. And they're just like, what the hell? How'd you do that? And, and again, like a real cartoonist, he always builds a story into it. It's never just, here's the character. It's always, they're doing, so there's some interesting scenario that makes you wish you could see what was going to happen next. And it's like, yeah, that's a real talent. That's real thought being put into things. And I wish everybody would to shoot for that. I know everybody doesn't have time, and a lot of times they're just lucky to squeeze in times for commissions. But, man, when you can do that, that's the way to go.
I quite agree. All right, dude, I think we did good. We got about 2.5 hours here.
So really?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, man.
No, that's good. This is good. We got the tangent show, which I think this is going to be. And then, it cut off at a very nice point. When I asked you if there was anything else we could talk about,
So that will be if you really, really like this stuff, here's another hour.
Yeah, I'm telling you, fans love these shows because they want to know, as I keep reminding you guys when I talk to you, they want to know where the inspirations come from. They want to know what you guys like. And if anything, it gives them a viewing and reading recommendation list that they go out and say, oh, man, I'd really like to see that Dean Martin, Jimmy Stewart movie. Where can I buy Bandolero?
Yeah, I like thinking everybody's going to rush out and get Bandolero as soon as they can.
I promise you I will get at least 5 to 10 emails saying, when you talked about this at about 15 minutes in, what were you guys talking about? Can you tell me where I can find it? What's the title of that movie? Where can I find that book? So, no, this is Parker, this is why we talk as much as we do. This is why we're talking to each
other. Anyway.
Likewise, man, and that's why at like 3 in the morning my time and everything, I'm on Twitter and like telling you guys what's on TCM. So, no, this is good, and I like I said, I imagine I'll have a similar conversation with Hardman in the next couple days or couple weeks.
Cool. I can't wait to hear that one.
So, very cool. And, honestly, continued success with everything you got going on. And I hope, like I said in the first part of our conversation, that 2011 just keeps moving things in the right direction.
Well, thank you.
That's Jeff Parker. Keep looking on the stands for things like The Red Hulk with Gabe Hardman, Thunderbolts with Kev Walker and Declan Shelvey, and, of course, coming soon, Bucko. It starts February 1st, Jeff's new webcomic. And it won't be too long before it'll be time for another conversation with Jeff. We'll be talking with Gabe Hardman in just a few days, and my voice hopefully will be back by then. So until then, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Word Balloon. John Sutra saying thanks again for listening. Don't forget to find us at wordballoon.com and at iFanboy. Look for our archive of episodes. Make sure you don't miss one episode of Word Balloon. Subscribe to the Word Balloon feed. Questions or comments about the show, email me, john@wordballoon.com. And of course, if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to leave on the Word Balloon hotline, it's 312-841-7025. And that includes any talk about any comic news, and you want to give your 2 cents, love to hear about it right here on Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2011.